Flight 841 kills 88.
We might live in the bush, but we go to Homer and Sterling and Soldotna. We know what's going on in the outside. Bombings by the IRA, the PLO, weathermen. Folks killing each other, kidnappings. All those girls disappearing in Washington State. Now someone is killing girls in Utah. The Symbionese Liberation Army, India testing nuclear bombs. It's only a matter of time before World War III starts. It could be nuclear or biological. And when that happens, the shit will really hit the fan.
Mad Earl nodded, murmured his agreement.
Mama, Lenny whispered, is all that true?
Mama lit up a cigarette.
A thing can be true and not be the truth. Now shush, we don't want to make him mad.
Dad was the center of attention, and he drank it up.
You all have done a great job of preparing for scarcity. You have excelled at homesteader self-reliance. You have a good water collection system and good food stores. You've staked out fresh water sources, and you're expert hunters. Your garden could be bigger, but it's well tended. You're ready to survive anything, except the effects of martial law. What do you mean?
Ted asked. Dad looked different somehow, taller. His shoulders were higher and more square than she'd seen before.
Nuclear war, a pandemic, an electromagnetic pulse, earthquake, tidal wave, tornado, Mount Denali blowing up, or Mount Rainier. In 1908, there was an explosion in Siberia that was 1,000 times more powerful than the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. There are a million ways for this sick, corrupt world to end.
Thelma frowned. Oh, come on, Ernst, there's no need to scare.
Shush, Thelma!
Mad Earl snapped.
Whatever comes, man-made tragedy or natural disaster, the first thing that happens is a breakdown of law and order.
Dad said.
Think of it. No power, no communications, no grocery stores, no uncontaminated food, no water, no civilization. Martial law.
Dad paused, made eye contact with each person, one by one.
People like Tom Walker, with his big house and expensive boats and his excavator, will be caught off guard. What good will all that land and wealth do him when he runs out of food or medical supplies? None. And you know what will happen when people like Tom Walker realize they aren't prepared? What?
Mad Earl stared up at Dad as if he'd just seen God.
He'll come here, banging on our doors, begging for help from us, the people he thought he was better than.
Dad paused.
We have to know how to protect ourselves and keep out the marauders who will want what we have. First off, we need to put together bug-out bags, packs that are already packed for survival. We need to be able to disappear at a moment's notice with everything we need. Yeah!
Someone yelled.
But that's not enough. We have a good start here, but security is lax. I think Bo left me his land, so I would find my way here to you and teach you that it's not enough to be prepared for survival. You have to fight for what's yours. Kill anyone who comes to take it from you. I know you are all hunters, but we need more than guns when TSHTF. Impact weapons break bones, knives sever arteries, arrows puncture. Before the first snowfall, I promise you, each one of us will be ready for the worst. Every single one of you, from youngest to oldest, will be able to protect yourself and your family from the danger that's coming.
Mad Earl nodded.
So, everyone line up. I want to assess precisely how good each of you is with a gun. We'll start there.
8. By the 1st of November, the days were shortening fast. Lenny felt the loss of every moment of light. Dawn came reluctantly at 9 a.m., and night reclaimed the world around 5 p.m. Barely 8 hours of daylight now, 16 hours of darkness. Night swept in like nothing Lenny had ever seen before, like the winged shadow of a creature too big and predatory to comprehend. Weather had become impossible to predict. It rained and snowed and rained again. Now the late afternoon sky spit down at them, a freezing mixture of sleet and rain. Water pooled on the ground, turned to sheets of dirty, weed-studded ice. Lenny had to do her chores in muck. After feeding the goats and chickens, she trudged into the woods behind the house, carrying two empty buckets. The cottonwoods were bare. Autumn had turned them into skeletons. Everything with a heartbeat was hunkered down somewhere, trying to get out of the sleet and rain. As she climbed the rise toward the river, a cold wind pulled at her hair, whined across her jacket. She hunched her shoulders and kept her head down. It took 5 trips to fill the steel water barrel they kept at the side of the house. Rain helped, but couldn't be relied upon. Water, like firewood, could never be left to chance. She was sweating hard, scooping a bucket of water from the creek, slopping it across her boots, when night fell. And she meant fell. It hit hard and fast, like a lid clanging down on its pot. When Lenny turned homeward, she saw an endless black expanse. Nothing distinguishable, no stars overhead, no moon to light a path. She fumbled in her parka pocket for the headlamp her dad had given her. She adjusted the strap and put it on, snapping the light switch. She pulled a pistol out of its holder, stuck it in her waistband. Her heart was hammering in her chest as she bent down and picked up the 2 buckets she'd filled with water. The metal hinges bit into her gloved hands. The icy rain turned to snow, stung her cheeks and forehead. Winter. The bears aren't in hibernation yet, are they? They are most dangerous now, feeding hungrily before going to sleep. She saw a pair of yellow eyes staring at her from the darkness. No, she was imagining it. The ground beneath her changed, gave way. She stumbled. Water sloshed out of the buckets and onto her gloves. Don't panic, don't panic, don't panic. Her headlight revealed a fallen log in front of her. Breathing hard, she stepped over it, heard the screech of bark against her jeans, and kept going. Up a hill, down one, around a dense black thicket. Finally, up ahead, she saw a glimmer. Light. The cabin. She wanted to run. She was desperate to get home, to feel her mother's arms around her, but she wasn't stupid. She had already made one mistake. She hadn't kept track of time. As she neared the cabin, the night separated a little. She saw charcoal outlines against the black, the sheen of the metal stovepipe poking up through the roof, a side window full of light, the shadow of people inside. The air smelled of wood smoke and welcome. Lenny rushed around to the side of the cabin, lifted the barrel's makeshift lid, and poured what was left of her water into the barrel. The split second between her upending the bucket and the sound of the water splashing in told her the barrel was about 3/4 full. Lenny was shaking so hard it took 2 tries for her to unlatch the door. "I'm back," she said, stepping into the cabin, her whole body shaking.
"Shut up, Lenny,"
Dad snapped. Mama stood in front of Dad. She was unsteady-looking, dressed in ragged sweats and a big sweater.
"Hey there, baby girl," she said. "Hang up your parka and take off your boots."
"I'm talking to you, Cora,"
Dad said. Lenny heard anger in his voice, saw her mother flinch.
"You have to take the rice back. Tell Large Marge we can't pay for it," he said.
"But you haven't gotten a moose yet," Mama said. "We need—"
"It's all my fault, is it?"
Dad shouted.
"That's not what I meant, and you know it. But winter's bearing down on us. We need more food than we have, and our money—"
"You think I don't know we need money?"
He swiped at the chair in front of him, sent it tumbling and cracking to the floor. The sudden wildness in his eyes, the showing of the whites, scared Lenny. She took a step backward. Mama went to him, touched his face, tried to gentle him.
"Ernt, baby, we'll figure it out."
He yanked back and headed for the door. Grabbing his parka from its place on the hook by the window, he pulled the door open, let in the sweeping, blinding cold, and slammed it shut behind him. A moment later, the VW bus engine roared to life. Headlights stabbed through the window, turned Mama golden white.
"It's the weather,"
Mama said, lighting a cigarette, watching him drive away. Her beautiful skin looked sallow in the headlight's glow, almost waxen. It's going to get worse, Lenny said. Every day is darker and colder. Yeah, Mama said, looking as scared as Lenny suddenly felt. I know. Winter tightened its grip on Alaska. The vastness of the landscape dwindled down to the confines of their cabin. The sun rose at 10:15 in the morning and set only 15 minutes after the end of the school day, less than 6 hours of light a day. Snow fell endlessly, blanketed everything. It piled up in drifts and spun its lace across window panes, leaving them nothing to see except themselves. In the few daylight hours, the sky stretched gray overhead. Some days there was merely the memory of light, rather than any real glow. Wind scoured the landscape, cried out as if in pain. The fireweed froze, turning into intricate ice sculptures that stuck up from the snow. In the freezing cold, everything stuck. Car doors froze, windows cracked, engines refused to start. The ham radio filled with warnings of bad weather and listed the deaths that were as common in Alaska in the winter as frozen eyelashes. People died for the smallest mistake. Car keys dropped in a river, a gas tank gone dry, a snow machine breaking down, a turn taken too fast. Lenny couldn't go anywhere or do anything without a warning. Already the winter seemed to have gone on forever. Shore ice seized the coastline, glazed the shells and stones until the beach looked like a silver-sequined collar. Wind roared across the homestead, as it had all winter, transforming the white landscape with every breath. Trees cowered in the face of it, animals built dens and burrowed holes and went into hiding. Not so different from the humans, who hunkered down in this cold, took special care. Lenny's life was the smallest it had ever been. On good days, when the bus would start and the weather was bearable, there was school. On bad days, there was only work, accomplished in this driving, demoralizing cold. Lenny focused on what needed to be done. Going to school, doing homework, feeding the animals, carrying water, cracking ice, darning socks, repairing clothes, cooking with Mama, cleaning the cabin, feeding the wood stove. Every day, more and more wood had to be chopped and carried and stacked. There was no room in these shortened days to think about anything beyond the mechanics of survival. They were growing starter vegetables in Dixie cups on a table beneath the loft. Even the practice of survival skills at the Harlan compound on weekends had been suspended. Worse than the weather was the confinement it caused. As winter pared their life away, the Albrights were left with only each other. Every evening was spent together, hours and hours of night, huddled around the wood stove. They were all on edge. Arguments erupted between her parents over money, over chores, over the weather, over nothing. Lenny knew how anxious Dad was about their inadequate supplies and their non-existent money. She saw how it gnawed at him. She saw, too, how closely Mama watched him, how worried she was about his rising anxiety. His struggle for calm was obvious in a dozen ticks and in the way he seemed unwilling to look at them sometimes. He woke well before dawn and stayed outside working as long as he could, coming back in well after dark and covered in snow, his mustache and eyebrows frozen, the tip of his nose white. The effort he made to keep his temper in check was apparent. As the days shortened and the nights lengthened, he began pacing after dinner, getting agitated and muttering to himself. On those bad nights, he took the traps Mad Earl had taught him to use and went trapping in the deep woods alone and came back exhausted, haggard-looking, quiet, himself. More often than not, he came home successful in the hunt, with fox or marten furs to sell in town. He made just enough money to keep them afloat, but even Lenny could see the empty shelves in their root cellar. No meal was ever big enough to fill them up. The money Mama had borrowed from Grandma was long gone, and there was none to take its place, so Lenny had stopped taking pictures, and Mama barely smoked. Large Marge sometimes gave them cigarettes and film for free when Dad wasn't looking, but they didn't go into town often. Dad's intentions were good, but even so, it was like living with a wild animal, like those crazy hippies the Alaskans talked about who lived with wolves and bears and invariably ended up getting killed. The natural-born predator could seem domesticated, even friendly, could lick your throat affectionately or rub up against you to get a back scratch. But you knew, or should know, that it was a wild thing you lived with, that a collar and leash and a bowl of food might tame the actions of the beast, but couldn't change its essential nature. In a split second, less time than it took to exhale a breath, that wolf could claim its nature and turn, fangs bared. It was exhausting to worry all the time, to study Dad's every movement and the tone of his voice. It had obviously worn Mama down. Anxiety had pulled the light from her eyes and the glow from her skin, or maybe the pallor came from living like mushrooms. On an especially cold day, Lenny woke to the sound of screaming. Something crashed to the floor. She knew instantly what was happening. Her dad had had a nightmare, his third one this week. She crawled out of her sleeping bag and went to the edge of the loft, peering down. Mama stood by the beaded door of her bedroom, holding a lantern high. In its white glow, she looked scared, her hair a mess, wearing sweatpants and a sweatshirt. The wood stove was a dot of orange in the dark. Dad was like an untamed animal, shoving, tearing, snarling, saying words she couldn't understand. Then he was wrenching open boxes, looking for something. Mama approached him cautiously, laid a hand on his back. He shoved her aside so hard she cracked into the log wall, cried out. Dad stopped. Jerked upright. His nostrils flared. He was flexing and unflexing his right hand. When he saw Mama, everything changed. His shoulders rounded. His head hung in shame.
"Jesus, Cora,"
he whispered brokenly.
"I'm sorry. I didn't know where I was."
"I know," she said, her eyes glistening with tears. He went to her, enfolded her in his arms, held her. They sank to their knees together, foreheads touching. Lenny could hear them talking, but couldn't make out the words. She returned to her sleeping bag and tried to go back to sleep.
"Lenny, get up! We're going hunting! I've got to get out of the goddamn house!"
With a sigh, she dressed in the darkness. In the first months of this Alaskan winter, she had learned to live like one of those phosphorescent invertebrates that roamed the sea floor, their lives untouched by any light or color except that which they generated themselves. In the living room, the wood stove offered a light through a narrow window in the black metal door. She could make out the silhouettes of her parents standing beside it, could hear their breathing. Coffee gurgled in a metal pot on top of the stove, puffed its welcoming scent into the darkness. Dad lit a lantern, held it up. In its orange glow, he looked haggard, tightly wound. A tick played at the corner of his right eye.
"You guys ready?"
Mama looked exhausted. Dressed in a huge parka and insulated pants, she looked too fragile for the weather and too tired to hike for much of a distance. In a week of rising nightmares and middle-of-the-night screaming, she wasn't sleeping well.
"Sure," Mama said. "I love to hunt at 6 a.m. on a Sunday morning."
Lenny went to the hooks on the wall, grabbed the gray parka and insulated pants she'd found at the Salvation Army in Homer last month, and the second-hand bunny boots Matthew had given her. She pulled down-filled gloves out of her parka pockets.
"Good,"
Dad said.
"Let's go."
This pre-dawn world was hushed. There was no wind, no cracking branches, just the endless sifting downward of snow, the white accumulating everywhere. Lenny trudged through the snow toward the animal pens. The goats stood huddled together, bleeding at her arrival, bumping into each other. She tossed them a flake of hay and then fed the chickens and broke the ice on their water troughs. When she got to the VW bus, Mama was already inside. Lenny climbed into the back seat. In this cold, the bus took a long time to start and even longer for the windows to defrost. The vehicle was not good in this part of the world. They'd learned that the hard way. Dad put chains on the tires and tossed a gear bag in the well between the front seats. Lenny sat in the back, her arms crossed, shivering, intermittently falling asleep and waking up. On the main road, Dad turned right toward town, but before the airstrip, he turned left onto the road that led to the abandoned chromium mine. They drove for miles on the hard-packed snow, the road a series of sharp switchbacks that seemed to be cut into the side of the mountain. Deep in the woods, high on the mountain, he parked suddenly, with a jarring stomp on the brakes, and handed them each a headlamp and a shotgun before hefting a pack and opening his door. Wind and snow and cold swept into the bus. It couldn't be much above zero up here. She fit the headlamp over her head, adjusted the strap, and turned on the light. It provided a bright, thin beam of light directly ahead. No stars, no starlight, snow falling hard and fast, a deep, abiding black full of whispering trees and crouching, hidden predators. Dad took off in front, trudging through the snow in his snowshoes, forging a path. Lenny let Mama go next, and then fell in step behind her. They walked for so long that Lenny's cheeks went from cold to hot to numb, long enough that her eyelashes and nostril hairs froze, that she felt her own sweat accumulating under her long underwear, itching. At some point, she started to smell, and it made her wonder what else could smell her. It was so easy to go from predator to prey out here. Lenny was so tired, just trudging forward, chin down, shoulders hunched, that it barely registered that at some point she began to see her own feet, her boots, her snowshoes. At first, there was the gray, ambient glow, light that wasn't quite real, bleeding up from the snow, and then the dawn, pink as salmon meat, buttery. Daylight. Lenny finally saw her surroundings. They were on a frozen river. It horrified her to realize she had followed Dad blindly onto its slick surface. What if the ice was too thin? One wrong step and someone could have plunged into the icy water and been swept away. Beneath her, she heard a cracking sound. Dad walked confidently forward, seemingly unconcerned about the ice beneath his feet. On the other shore, he cut a path through stubby, snow-coated brush, stared down, tilted his head as if he were listening. His face above the snowy beard was red with cold. She knew he was following signs, droppings, tracks. Snowshoe hares did most of their feeding and movement at dawn and dusk. He stopped suddenly.
"There's a hare over there," he said to Lenny, "at the edge of the trees."
Lenny looked in the direction he pointed. Everything was white, even the sky. Shapes were difficult to distinguish in this white-on-white world. Then movement. A plump white hare hopped forward.
"Yeah," she said. "I see it."
"Okay, Lenny. This is your hunt. Breathe. Relax. Wait for the shot,"
Dad said. She lifted her gun. She'd been target shooting for months, so she knew what to do. She breathed in and out instead of holding her breath. She focused on the hare, aimed. She waited. The world fell away, became simple. There was just her and the hare, predator and prey connected. She squeezed the trigger. It all seemed to happen simultaneously. The shot, the hit, the kill, the hare slumping sideways. A good, clean shot.
"Excellent,"
Dad said. Lenny slung her shotgun over her shoulder, and the three of them set off single file for the tree line and Lenny's kill. When they reached the hare, Lenny stared down at it, the soft white body sprayed with blood, lying in a pool of it. She'd killed something, fed her family for another night, killed something, stopped a life. She didn't know how to feel about it, or maybe she just felt two conflicting emotions at the same time, proud and sad. In truth, she almost wanted to cry, but she was Alaskan now, this was her life. Without hunting, there was no food on the table. And nothing would go to waste. The fur would be made into a hat. The bones would make a soup stock. Tonight, Mama would fry the meat in home-churned butter made from goat's milk and season it with onions and garlic. They might even splurge and add a few potatoes. Her dad knelt in the snow. She saw the shaking of his hands and could tell by the tautness of his voice that he had a headache as he turned the dead hare onto its back. He placed his blade at the tail and cut upward, through the skin and bone, in a single, sweeping cut. At the hare's breastbone, he slowed, positioned one bloody finger under the knife blade and proceeded cautiously to avoid accidentally cutting any organs. He opened the animal, reached in, and pulled out the entrails, which he left in a steaming red-pink pile on the snow. He picked out the small, plump heart and held it up to Lenny. Blood leaked between his fingers.
"You're the hunter. Eat the heart."
"Ernt, please," Mama said. "We're not savages."
"That's exactly what we are,"
he said in a voice as cold as the wind at their back.
"Eat it."
Lenny's gaze cut to Mama, who looked as horrified as Lenny felt.
"Are you going to make me ask again?"
Dad said. The quiet of his voice was worse than yelling. Lenny felt a ridge of fear poke up, spread along her spine. She reached out, took the tiny blue-red organ in her hand. Was it still beating or was she trembling? With her father's narrowed gaze steady on her, she put the heart in her mouth and forced her lips to close. Instantly, she wanted to gag. The heart was slippery and slimy. When she bit down, it ruptured in her mouth, tasting metallic. She felt blood trickle out the side of her mouth. She swallowed, gagged, wiped the blood from her lips, felt its warmth smear across her cheek. Her father looked up, just enough to make eye contact. He looked ruined, tired, but present. In his eyes, she saw more love and sadness than should be able to exist in one human being. Something was tearing him up inside, even now. It was the other man, the bad man, who lived inside of him and tried to break out in the darkness.
"I'm trying to make you self-sufficient."
It sounded like an apology, but for what? For being crazy sometimes, or teaching her to hunt? Or for making her eat the hare's beating heart, or for the nightmares that ruined all their sleep? Or maybe he was apologizing for something he hadn't done yet, but was afraid he would. December. Dad was edgy, tense. He drank too much and muttered under his breath. The nightmares became more frequent, 3 a week, every week. He was always moving, demanding, pushing. He ate, slept, breathed, and drank survival. He had become a soldier again, or that's what Mama said, and Lenny found herself tongue-tied around him, afraid of saying or doing the wrong thing. With as hard as she worked after school and on the weekends, Lenny should have slept like the dead, but she didn't. Night after night, she lay awake, worrying. Her fear and anxiety about the world had been sharpened to a knife point. Even as exhausted as she was, she lay awake, listening for his screams. When she did finally fall asleep, she landed in a dreamscape on fire, a place full of danger, a world at war, animals being slaughtered, girls being kidnapped, men screaming and pointing guns. She screamed for Matthew, but no one could hear one girl's voice in a falling-apart world, and besides, what good would he be? She couldn't tell Matthew this, not this. Some fears you carried alone.
"Lenny!"
She heard her name being called from far away. Where was she? It was the middle of the night. Was she still dreaming? Someone grabbed her, yanked her out of bed. It was real this time. A hand clamped over her mouth. She recognized his smell. "Dad," she said through his hand.
"Come on," he said. "Now."
She stumbled over to the ladder, climbed down behind him in an utter darkness. None of the lamps were lit downstairs, but she could hear her mother breathing heavily. Dad led Lenny to the newly fixed and steady card table, guided her to a seat.
"Ernt, really?" Mama said.
"Shut up, Cora,"
Dad said. Something banged onto the table in front of Lenny with a clatter and a clang.
"What is it?"
he said, standing right next to her. She reached out, her fingers trailing across the rough surface of the card table. A rifle, in pieces.
"You need better training, Lenny. When the TSHTF, we'll have to do things differently. What if it's winter? Everything might be dark. You'll be off guard, confused, sleepy. Excuses will get you killed. I want you to be able to do everything in the dark when you're scared."
"Ernt," Mama said from the darkness, her voice uneven.
She's just a girl. Let her go back to bed.
When men are starving and we have food, will they care that she's just a girl?
Lenny heard the click of a stopwatch.
Go, Lenny. Clean your weapon. Put it back together.
Lenny reached out, felt for the cold pieces of the rifle, pulled them toward her. The darkness unnerved her, made her slow. She saw a match flare in the darkness, smelled a cigarette being lit.
Stop,
Dad said. A flashlight beam erupted, blared into being, focused on the rifle.
Unacceptable. You're dead. All of our food is gone. Maybe one of them is thinking of rape.
He grabbed the rifle, disassembled it, and pushed the pieces to the center of the table. In the blast of light, Lenny saw the rifle in parts, in addition to a cleaning rod, cloths, some Hops-9 solvent, and rust protector, a few screwdrivers. She tried to memorize where everything was. He was right. She needed to know how to do this or she could be killed. Concentrate. The light clicked off. The stopwatch clicked on.
Go.
Lenny reached out, trying to remember what she'd seen. She pulled the rifle parts toward her, assembled it quickly, screwed the scope in place. She was reaching for the cleaning cloth when the stopwatch clicked off.
Dead,
Dad said in disgust.
Try again.
Yesterday, on the second Saturday in December, they joined their neighbors for a tree-cutting party. They all hiked out into the wilderness and chose trees. Dad cut down an evergreen, dragged it onto their sled, and hauled it back to the cabin, where they placed it in the corner beneath the loft. They decorated it with family Polaroids and fishing lures. A few presents wrapped in yellowed pages from the Anchorage Daily Times were positioned beneath the fragrant green branches. Magic marker lines pretended to be ribbon. The propane-fueled hanging lanterns created a warm interior, their light a sharp contrast to the still dark morning. Wind clawed at the eaves. Every now and then a tree branch smacked hard against the cabin. Now, on Sunday afternoon, Mama was in the kitchen, making sourdough bread. The yeasty fragrance of baking bread filled the cabin. The bad weather kept them all inside. Dad was hunched over the ham radio, listening to scratchy voices, his fingers constantly working the knobs. Lenny heard the staticky sound of Mad Earl's voice, his high-pitched cackle coming through loud and clear. Lenny sat huddled on the sofa, reading the ragged paperback copy of Go Ask Alice she'd found at the dump. The world felt impossibly small here. The drapes were drawn tightly for warmth, and the door was locked shut against cold and predators.
What was that? Say again, over?
Dad said. He was hunched over the ham radio, listening.
Marge, is that you?
Lenny heard Large Marge's voice come through the radio, broken up, spangled with static.
Emergency! Lost! Search party! Past Walker Cabin! Meet on Mine Road! Out!
Lenny put down her book, sat up.
Who is lost? In this weather?
Large Marge,
Dad said.
Come in. Who is it? Who is lost? Earl, you there?
Static. Dad turned.
Get dressed. Someone needs help.
Mama took the half-baked bread out of the oven and set it on the counter, covering it with a dishcloth. Lenny dressed in the warmest clothes she had, Carhartt insulated pants rolled up at the hem, parka, bunny boots. Within 5 minutes of the call from Large Marge, Lenny was in the back of the bus, waiting for the engine to start. It would be a while. Finally, Dad got the windshield scraped enough to see through. Then he checked the chains and climbed into the driver's seat.
It's a bad day for someone to get lost.
Dad slowly maneuvered around in the axle-deep snow, turned toward their driveway, which was a thick, unbroken layer of white, without tire tracks, bracketed by snow-covered trees. Lenny could see her breath. That was how cold it was inside the bus. Snow built up and disappeared on the windshield in between each swipe of the wiper blades. As they neared town, vehicles appeared out of the curtain of falling snow in front of them, headlights glowing through the gloom. Up ahead, Lenny saw amber and red lights flashing. That would be Natalie and her snowplow, leading the way onto a barely there road that led toward the old mine. Dad eased up on the gas. They slowed, pulled into line behind a big pickup truck that belonged to Clyde Harlan, and drove up the mountain. When they reached a clearing, Lenny saw a bunch of snow machines. Lenny still thought of them as snowmobiles, but no one called them that up here, parked in an uneven line. They belonged to the residents who lived in the bush, without roads to their homesteads. All of them had their lights on and their engines running. Falling snow braided through the light beams and gave it all an eerie, otherworldly look. Dad parked alongside a snow machine. Lenny followed her parents out into the falling snow and howling wind, into the kind of cold that burrowed deep. They saw Mad Earl and Thelma and made their way over to their friends.
"What's up?"
Dad shouted to be heard above the wind. Before Mad Earl or Thelma could answer, Lenny heard the high-pitched wail of a whistle being blown. A man in a heavy blue insulated parka and pants stepped forward. A wide-brimmed hat identified him as a policeman.
"I'm Kurt Ward. Thanks for coming. Geneva and Matthew Walker are missing. They were supposed to arrive at their hunting cabin an hour ago. This is their usual route. If they're lost or hurt, we should find them between here and the cabin."
Lenny didn't realize she'd cried out until she felt her mother's reassuring touch. "Matthew." She looked up at her mother. "He'll freeze out here," she said. "It will be night soon." Before Mama could answer, Officer Ward said,
"Space yourselves about 20 feet apart."
He began handing out flashlights. Lenny turned her flashlight on, stared out at the lane of snow-covered ground in front of her. The whole world spiraled down to a single strip of land. She saw it in layers, bumpy white snow-covered ground, snow-filled air, white trees pointing up to a gray sky. "Where are you, Matthew?" She moved slowly, doggedly forward, distantly aware of other searchers, other lights. She heard dogs barking and voices raised. Searchlights crisscrossed each other. Time passed in a weird, surreal way, in light diminishing and breaths exhaled. Lenny saw animal tracks, a pile of bones mixed with fresh blood, fallen spruce needles. Wind had sculpted the snow into peaks and swirls with glazed and hardened icy tips. Tree wells were black with debris, made by animals into makeshift dens that gave them a place to sleep out of the wind. The trees around her thickened. The temperature dropped suddenly. She felt a rush of cold as day gave way to night. It stopped snowing. Wind pushed the clouds away and left in their stead a navy blue sky awash in swirls of starlight. A gibbous moon shone down, its light bright on the snow. Ambient silver light set the world aglow. She saw something. Arms. Reaching up from the snow, thin fingers splayed out, frozen. She lunged forward through the deep snow, said, "I'm coming, Matthew!" through wheezing, painful breaths, her light bobbing up and down in front of her. Antlers. A full set, shed by a bull moose. Or maybe beneath this snow lay the bones left by a poacher. Like so many sins, the snow covered it all. The truth wouldn't be revealed until spring, if ever. The wind picked up, banged through the trees, sent branches flying. She trudged forward, one light amid dozens spread out through the glowing blue-white-black forest, pinpricks of yellow searching, searching. She heard Mr. Walker's voice call out, yelling Matthew's name so often he started to sound hoarse. "There! Up ahead!" someone yelled. And Mr. Walker yelled back,
"I see him!"
Lenny plunged forward, trying to run through the deep snow. Up ahead, she saw a shadowy lump, a person, kneeling by the side of a frozen river in the moonlight, head bowed forward. Lenny shoved through the crowd, elbowed her way to the front, just as Mr. Walker squatted beside his son.
"Maddie!"
he shouted to be heard, laid a gloved hand on his son's back.
"I'm here! I'm here! Where's your mom?"
Maddie's head slowly turned. His face was starkly white, his lips were chapped, his green eyes seemed to have lost their hue, taken color from the ice around him. The ice beneath him glowed with moonlight. He was shaking uncontrollably.
"She's gone," he croaked, his voice raw. "Phil."
Mr. Walker hauled his son to his feet. Twice Matthew almost collapsed, but his dad held him upright. Lenny heard people talking in snippets. Fell through the ice. Should know better. Jesus.
Come on, Officer Ward said. Let him through. We need to get this kid warmed up.
9. Winter had claimed one of them, one who had been born here, who knew how to survive. Lenny couldn't stop thinking about that, worrying about it. If Geneva Walker, Jenny, the generator I answer to anything, could be lost so easily, no one was safe. My God, Thelma said as they walked solemnly back to their vehicles. Jenny didn't make mistakes on the ice.
Everyone makes mistakes,
Large Marge said, her dark face crumpled with grief. Natalie Watkins nodded solemnly.
I've crossed that river a dozen times this month. Jesus, how could she fall through this time of year?
Lenny was listening and not listening. All she could think about was Matthew and what he must be going through now. He'd seen his mother fall through the ice and die. How could you get over a thing like that? Every time Matthew closed his eyes, wouldn't he see it again? Wouldn't he wake up screaming from nightmares for the rest of his life? How could she help him? Back at home, shivering with cold and a new fear, you could lose your parents or your life on a normal Sunday just out walking in the snow, gone, she wrote him a series of letters, each one of which she tore up because it wasn't right. She was still trying to compose the perfect letter 2 days later when the town came together for Geneva's funeral. On this freezing cold afternoon, dozens of vehicles were in town, parked wherever they could, on roadsides, in vacant lots. One was practically in the middle of the street. Lenny had never seen so many trucks and snow machines in town at one time. All of the businesses were closed, even the Kicking Moose Saloon. Connick was hunkered down for winter, glazed in snow and ice, illuminated by the ambient glow of daylight. The world could tumble, change radically in 2 days with just one less person living in it. They parked on Alpine Street and got out of the bus. She heard the whining drone of a generator's motor, grumbling loudly, powering the lights in the church on the hill. Single file, they trudged up the hill. Light filled the dusty windows of the old church, smoke puffed up from the chimney. At the closed door, Lenny paused just long enough to peel the fur-trimmed hood back from her face. She'd seen this church on every trip to town, but she'd never been inside. The interior was smaller than it looked from the outside, with chipped white plank walls and a pine floor. There were no pews. People filled the space from side to side. A man dressed in camouflage snow pants and a fur coat stood up front, his face practically hidden by a mustache, beard, and mutton chops. Everyone Lenny had ever met in Connick was here. She saw Large Marge standing between Mr. Rhodes and Natalie. The whole Harlan family was here, squished in close to one another. Even Crazy Pete was here, with his goose settled on his hip. But it was the front row that held her attention. Mr. Walker stood beside a beautiful blonde girl who must be Alyeska, home from college, and alongside Walker relatives Lenny hadn't met. Off to their right, standing together with them and yet somehow alone, was Matthew. Calhoun Malvey, Geneva's boyfriend, kept shifting his weight, moving from foot to foot as if he didn't know what to do. His eyes were red-rimmed. Lenny tried to get Matthew's attention, but even the opening and closing of the church's double doors and the subsequent sweep of cold and snow didn't faze him. He stood there, shoulders slumped, chin dropped, his profile veiled by hair that looked like it hadn't been washed in a week. Lenny followed her parents to an empty space behind Mad Earl's family and stood there. Mad Earl immediately handed Dad a flask. Lenny stared at Matthew, willing him to look at her. She didn't know what she'd say when they finally got to talk. Maybe she wouldn't say anything, would just take his hand. The priest, or was he a reverend, a minister, a father, what? Lenny had no idea about things like this, started to talk.
We here all knew Geneva Walker. She wasn't a member of this church, but she was one of us from the moment Tom brought her here from Fairbanks. She was game for anything and never gave up. Remember when Allie talked her into singing the national anthem at Salmon Days, and she was so bad that the dogs started howling, and even Matilda waddled away? And after it was all over, Jen said, "Well, I can't sing a lick, but who cares? It's what my Allie wanted." Or when Jenny hooked Tom in the cheek at the fishing derby and tried to claim the prize for biggest catch, she had a heart as big as Alaska.
He paused, sighed.
Our Jen. She was a woman who knew how to love. We don't quite know whose wife she was at the end, but that doesn't matter. We all loved her.
Laughter, quiet and sad. Lenny lost track of the words. She wasn't even sure how much time had passed. It made her think of her own mother and how it would feel to lose her. Then she heard people start to turn for the door, boots stomping, floorboards creaking. It was over. Lenny tried to make her way to Matthew, but it was impossible. Everyone was pushing toward the door. As far as Lenny could tell, no one had said anything about going down to the Kicking Moose Saloon afterward, but they all ended up there just the same. Maybe it was adult instinctive behavior. She followed her parents down the hill and across the street and into the charred, tumble-down interior. The minute she crossed the threshold, she smelled the acrid, sooty smell of burnt wood. Apparently, that smell never went away. The interior was cave-like, with propane fuel lanterns swinging creakily from the rafters, throwing light like streams of water on the patrons below, set in motion by the tap of the wind every time the door opened. Old Jim was behind the bar, serving drinks as fast as he could. A wet gray bar rag hung over one shoulder, dripped dark splotches down the front of his flannel shirt. Lenny had heard someone say that he'd bartended here for decades. He'd started back when the few men who lived in this wilderness were either hiding out from or coming home from World War II. Dad ordered 4 drinks at once, downed them in rapid succession. The sawdust floor gave off a dusty, barn-like scent and muffled the footsteps of so many people. They were talking all at once in the low voices of grief. Lenny heard snippets, adjectives. Beautiful. Give you the shirt off her back. Best damn nettle bread. Tragedy. She saw how death impacted people, saw the glazed look in their eyes, the way they shook their heads, the way their sentences broke in half as if they couldn't decide if silence or words would release them from sorrow. Lenny had never known anyone who had died before. She had seen death on television and read about it in her beloved books. Johnny's death in The Outsiders had turned her inside out, but now she saw the truth of it. In literature, death was many things, a message, catharsis, retribution. There were deaths that came from a beating heart that stopped, and deaths of another kind, a choice made, like Frodo going to the Grey Havens. Death made you cry, filled you with sadness, but in the best of her books, there was peace too, satisfaction, a sense of the story ending as it should. In real life, she saw, it wasn't like that. It was sadness opening up inside of you, changing how you saw the world. It made her think about God and what he offered at times like this. She wondered for the first time what her parents believed in, what she believed in, and she saw how the idea of heaven could be comforting. She could hardly imagine a thing as terrible as losing your mother. The very thought of it made Lenny sick to her stomach. Your mother was a kite string. Without her strong, steady hold on you, you might just float away, be lost somewhere among the clouds. She didn't want to think about a loss like that, the bone-breaking magnitude of it. But at a time like this, there was no looking away, and when she did look it in the face, without blinking or turning away, she knew this. If she were Matthew, she would need a friend right now. Who knew how the friend could help? Whether offering silent companionship or a clatter of words was better. That, the how, she would have to figure out on her own. But the what? Friendship. That she knew for sure. She knew when the walkers entered the tavern by the silence that fell. People turned to face the door. Mr. Walker entered first. He was so tall and broad-shouldered, he had to duck to pass through the low door. Long blonde hair fell across his face. He shoved it back. Looking up, he saw everyone staring at him, and he stopped, straightened. His gaze moved slowly around the room, from face to face. His smile faded. Grief aged him. The beautiful blonde girl came up behind him, her face wet with tears. She had her arm around Matthew, was holding him like a Secret Service agent moving an unpopular Nixon through an angry mob. Matthew's shoulders were rounded, his body hunched forward, his face downcast. Cal hovered behind them, his eyes glassy. Mr. Walker saw Mama, move toward her first.
"I'm so sorry, Tom,"
Mama said, her face tilted up to him, crying. Mr. Walker looked down at her.
"I should have been with them."
"Oh, Tom."
She touched his arm.
"Thanks,"
he said in a hoarse, lowered voice. He swallowed hard, seemed to stop himself from saying more. He looked at the friends gathered close.
"I know church funerals aren't our favorite, but it's so damn cold out, and Geneva did love the idea of church."
There was a murmur of agreement, a sense of restless motion contained, of relief mingled with grief.
"To Jen,"
Large Marge said, lifting her shot glass. "To Jen." As the adults clinked their glasses and downed their drinks and turned their attention to the bar for another round, Lenny watched the Walker family move through the crowd, stopping to talk to everyone.
"Pretty highfalutin' funeral,"
Mad Earl said loudly, drunkenly. Lenny glanced sideways to see if Tom Walker had heard, but Mr. Walker was talking to Large Marge and Natalie.
"What do you expect?"
Dad said, downing another whiskey. His eyes had the glazed look of drunkenness.
"I'm surprised the governor didn't fly down to tell us how to feel. I hear he and Tom are fishing buddies. He loves to remind us peons of that."
Mama moved closer. "Ernst, it is the day of his wife's funeral. Can't we—"
"Don't you say a word,"
Dad hissed.
"I saw the way you were hanging all over him."
Thelma pushed in closer. "Oh, for God's sake, Ernst, this is a sad day. Sow the jealousy for 10 minutes.
"You think I'm jealous of Tom?"
Dad said. He glanced at Mama.
"Should I be?"
Lenny turned her back on them, watched Alyeska hustle Matthew through the mourners, over to a quiet corner in the back. Lenny followed, eased between people who stank of wood smoke and sweat and body odor. Bathing was a luxury in midwinter. No one did it often enough. Matthew stood alone, staring blankly forward, with his back to the charred, black peeling wall. Soot peppered his sleeves. She was shocked by how changed he looked. He couldn't have lost that much weight in such a short time, but his cheekbones were like ridges above his hollow cheeks. His lips were chapped and bloodied. A patch of skin was white at his temple, the color a sharp contrast to his wind-burned cheeks. His hair was dirty and hung in limp, thin strands on either side of his face.
"Hey,"
she said.
"Hey,"
he answered dully. "Now what?" "Don't say I'm sorry. That's what grown-ups say, and it's stupid. Of course you're sorry. How does that help?" "But what?" She edged forward cautiously, careful not to touch him, and sidled up beside him, leaning back against the burnt wall. From here, she could see everything, the lanterns hanging from burnt rafters, walls covered with dusty antique snowshoes and fishnets and cross-country skis, ashtrays overflowing, smoke blurring everything, and everyone. Her parents were huddled with Mad Earl and Clyde and Thelma and the rest of the Harlan family. Even through the cigarette smoke haze, Lenny could see how red her dad's face was, a sign of too much whiskey, how his eyes were narrowed in anger as he talked. Mama looked defeated beside him, afraid to move, afraid to add to the conversation or to look at anything except her husband.
"He blames me."
Lenny was so surprised to hear Matthew speak that it took her a moment to process what he'd said. Her gaze followed his to Mr. Walker.
"Your dad?" Lenny turned to him. "He couldn't. It's not anyone's fault. She just—" "I mean, the ice—"
Matthew started to cry. Tears streamed down his face as he stood there, stock still, so tense he seemed to be vibrating. In his eyes, she glimpsed a bigger world. Being lonely, being afraid, a volatile, angry dad. These were bad things that gave you nightmares. But they were nothing compared to watching your mother die. How would that feel? How would you ever get over it? And how was she, a 14-year-old girl with troubles of her own, supposed to help?
"They found her yesterday," he said.
"Did you hear? One of her legs was missing, and her face..."
She touched him. "Don't think..." At her touch, he let out a howl of pain that drew everyone's attention. He roared with it again, shuddered. Lenny froze, unsure of what to do. Should she pull away or push forward? She reacted instinctively, took him in her arms. He melted into her, held her so tightly she couldn't breathe. She felt his tears on her neck, warm and wet.
"It's my fault. I keep having these nightmares, and I wake up so pissed off I can't stand it."
Before Lenny could say anything, the pretty blonde girl moved in beside Matthew, put an arm around him, pulled him away from Lenny. Matthew stumbled into his sister, moving unsteadily, as if even walking felt unfamiliar.
"You must be Lenny," Alyeska said.
Lenny nodded.
"I'm Allie, Maddie's big sister. He told me about you."
She was trying hard to smile. That was obvious.
"Said you were best friends."
Lenny wanted to cry.
"We are. That's lucky. I didn't have anyone my age in school when I lived here," Allie said, tucking her hair behind one ear. "I guess it's why Fairbanks seemed like a good idea. I mean, Connick and the homestead can feel as small as a speck sometimes, but I should have been here."
"Don't," Matthew said to his sister. "Please."
Allie's smile wavered. Lenny didn't know this girl at all, but her struggle for composure and her love for her brother were obvious. It made Lenny feel strangely connected to her, as if they had this one important thing in common.
"I'm glad he has you. He's struggling now, aren't you, Maddie?"
Allie's voice broke.
"But he'll be fine, I hope."
Lenny saw suddenly how hope could break you, how it was a shiny lure for the unwary. What happened to you if you hoped too hard for the best and got the worst? Was it better not to hope at all, to prepare? Wasn't that what her father's lesson always was? Prepare for the worst.
"Of course he will,"
Lenny said, but she didn't believe it. She knew what nightmares could do to a person and how bad memories could change who you were. On the drive home, no one spoke. Lenny felt the loss of every second of light as night fell, felt it as sharply as a mallet striking bone. She imagined her father could hear them, the lost seconds, like stones clattering down a rock wall, plunking somewhere into black, murky water. Mama huddled in her seat, hunched over. She kept glancing at Dad. He was drunk and angry. He bounced in his seat, thumped his hand on the steering wheel. Mama reached out, touched his arm. He yanked away from her, said,
"You're good at that, aren't you? Touching men. You think I didn't see? You think I'm stupid?"
Mama looked at him wide-eyed, fear etched onto her delicate features.
"I don't think that."
"I saw how you looked at him. I saw it."
He muttered something and pulled away from her. Lenny thought he said, "breathe" under his breath, but she couldn't be sure. All she knew was that they were in trouble.
"I saw you touch his hand."
This was bad. He'd always been jealous of Tom Walker's money. This was something else. All the way home, as he muttered under his breath, "whore, bitch, lied," his fingers played piano keys on the steering wheel. At the homestead, he stumbled out of the bus and stood there swaying, looking at the cabin. Mama went up to him. They stared at each other, both breathing unsteadily.
"Make a fool of me again, will you?"
Mama touched his arm.
"You don't really think I want Tom..."
He grabbed Mama by the arm and dragged her into the cabin. She tried to pull free, stumbled forward, put her hand over his in a feeble attempt to make him ease his grip. "Ernst, please!" Lenny ran after them, followed them into the cabin, saying, "Dad, please, let her go!" "Lenny, go!" Mom started to say. Dad hit Mama so hard she flew sideways, cracked her head into the log wall, and crumpled to the floor. Lenny screamed, "Mama!" Mama crawled to her knees, got unsteadily to her feet. Her lip was ripped, bleeding. Dad hit her again, harder. When she hit the wall, he looked down, saw the blood on his knuckles, and stared at it. A high, keening howl of pain burst out of him, ringing off the log walls. He stumbled back, putting distance between them. He gave Mama a long, desperate look of sorrow and hatred, then ran out of the cabin, slamming the door behind him. Lenny was so scared and surprised and horrified by what she'd just seen, she did nothing. Nothing. She should have thrown herself at Dad, gotten between them, even gone for her gun. She heard the door slam, and it knocked her out of her paralysis. Mama was sitting on the floor in front of the wood stove, her hands in her lap and her head forward, her face hidden by her hair.
"Mama?"
Mama slowly looked up, tucked the hair behind her ear. A red splotch marred her temple. Her lower lip was split open, dripping blood onto her pants. "Do something." Lenny ran into the kitchen, soaked a washcloth with water from the bucket, and went to Mama, kneeling beside her. With a tired smile, Mama took the rag, pressed it to her bleeding lip.
"Sorry, baby girl,"
she said through the cloth.
"He hit you,"
Lenny said, stunned. This was an ugliness she'd never imagined. A lost temper, yes. A fist? Blood? No. "You were supposed to be safe in your own home, with your parents. They were supposed to protect you from the dangers outside."
"He was agitated all day. I shouldn't have talked to Tom,"
Mama sighed.
"And now I suppose he's gone to the compound to drink whiskey and eat hate with Mad Earl."
Lenny looked at her mother's beaten, bruised face, the rag turning red with her blood.
"You're saying it's your fault? You're too young to understand. He didn't mean to do that. He just loves me too much sometimes."
Was that true? Was that what love was when you grew up?
"He meant to,"
Lenny said quietly, feeling a cold wave of understanding wash through her. Memories clicked into place like pieces of a puzzle, fitting together. Mama's bruises, her always saying, "I'm clumsy." She had hidden this ugly truth from Lenny for years. Her parents had been able to hide it from her with walls and lies, but here, in this one-room cabin, there was no hiding anymore.
"He has hit you before?"
"No," Mama said.
"Hardly ever."
Lenny tried to put it all together in her head, make it make sense, but she couldn't. How could this be love? How could it be Mama's fault?
"We have to understand and forgive," Mama said. "That's how you love someone who's sick, someone who is struggling. It's like he has cancer. That's how you have to think of it. He'll get better. He will. He loves us so much."
Lenny heard her mother start to cry, and somehow that made it worse, as if her tears watered this ugliness, made it grow. Lenny pulled Mama into her arms, held her tightly, stroked her back just like Mama had done so many times for Lenny. Lenny didn't know how long she sat there, holding her mother, replaying the horrible scene over and over. Then she heard her father's return. She heard his uneven footsteps on the deck, his fumbling with the door latch. Mama must have heard it too, because she was crawling unsteadily to her feet, pushing Lenny aside, saying, "Go upstairs." Lenny watched her Mama rise. She dropped the wet, bloody rag. It fell with a splat to the floor. The door opened. Cold rushed in.
"You came back,"
Mama whispered. Dad stood in the doorway, his face lined in agony, his eyes full of tears.
"Cora, my God,"
he said, his voice scratchy and thick.
"Of course